Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. When it comes to the coronavirus, it can feel as though you need a degree in science to keep up with developments. That's where Michael Despezio comes in. Michael's a biologist, educator, and science author. He's developed a website and blog on the science of the coronavirus. Michael Despezio, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
Now, we've had a steep learning curve on the coronavirus since the beginning of the year, and to complicate matters, the narrative from public health officials and the government about how this virus is transmitted and how we should protect ourselves and others changed frequently during February and March. So during a public health crisis, the dissemination of clear and accurate information is essential. So in those early days, where were you turning for information?
Great question. The internet offers an incredible resource for most people, especially if you have background in science. You can get and access some of the latest publications within a day of their being posted on the internet. So what I've been doing is trying to keep up as much as possible by going to the specific sites or looking for specific topics that I'm interested in, which I think help people construct an understanding of COVID-19.
Now, there are few people alive who lived through the last pandemic in 1918. Thanks to vaccines, other diseases such as mumps, polio, diphtheria are rare. So unless you're an epidemiologist, you probably don't spend a lot of time worrying about contagions. How do you think the coronavirus will change the narrative in public health and school curriculums about disease transmission?
And now that's a great question, because we look at how do we make students good decision makers. And part of the next generation science standards, which is really driving science education in this country, is to have students understand higher level concepts so that they can become critical thinkers and make decisions which will keep them safe. If you look at the current science standards, you find out that viruses aren't even in there. Certainly, we talk about health, we talk about immune system, but this is in the upper grades. What I think is going to happen is that there is going to be a much greater awareness built into the teaching of health concepts in the lower grades. So where kids, say, in grade band K through 2 are learning just the basics of good hygiene, now it may be tied into more about how do you protect yourself from the spread of a germ, and maybe begin to talk about germs at this younger level as opposed to waiting until they're up in the elementary or certainly by the time they're in the middle school grades learning about it. So I think it is going to shift education by putting much more of a focus on staying healthy with these students, because it is so important. This is what we do. This is critical in understanding so that the students construct for themselves a safe way of acting.
We're going to jump right into talk about some of the topics that you cover in your COVID-19 blog. And listeners, if you have a question about the coronavirus, take this opportunity to get an answer. You can join us at 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So let's start with the very basics. What is a virus?
That's a great question, because, you know, if you go to most people and you say, what causes COVID-19, it's almost a knee-jerk reaction, and they go, it's a virus. But then if you ask them, what is a virus, you get a wait. You know, viruses are incredible. I am fascinated by them, because these are the ultimate parasites, and they exist at the edge of life. I've got a question for you. I want you to think back to your biology class that you might have had in college or in high school. And if I ask you a question, say, what is a cell? Do you remember the concept of a cell? Do you remember what it was?
Yeah. Those tiny little organisms of life. Everything alive starts with a cell, right?
You got it. It's a building block of life. And whether it's a single-celled animal like an amoeba or a paramecium, or a multicellular animal such as ourselves, we have these components. And all of these components, these building blocks, share certain characteristics. They share characteristics in what they do, in what are called the life processes, and also in their structure, so that they are able to maintain what is called the living condition, where the animal is able to use energy. It has a certain type of metabolism going on. It can grow. It can differentiate. Now, if you look at all these things that a cell has, then you turn your direction and focus onto a virus. A virus has none of that. A virus is stripped down, so it is the ultimate parasite. It doesn't have those cell organelles that you learned about. It doesn't have a nucleus, a mitochondria, maybe chloroplasts, cell membranes, all of that, non-existent. Basically, basically all a virus is this spaceship which travels through space. It has a protective shell in many cases. We can look at SARS-CoV-2 at a little bit more of its structure later on, but it has this protective shell, and inside that protective shell, we have the blueprints for making more viruses. So when a virus infects a cell, it injects its blueprints into that host cell, and it hijacks the living cell machinery to make new virus particles. And that's what a virus is.
So describe the specifics of the COVID-19 virus.
All right, the COVID-19 virus, SARS-CoV-2 is its official name, and it is what is called a coronavirus. And there are several dozen types of coronaviruses, and all of these viruses share common characteristics. What are those characteristics? Well, if you look at these viruses with a super powerful microscope, it's called a TEM, or a transmission electron microscope, you can notice that the exterior of these virus particles, which are very small, have what look like studs sticking out from the virion, from the particle itself. And this gives it an appearance of a halo or a corona, hence the word coronavirus. So we have a virus particle, extremely small. There are several different types, as I said, of coronaviruses that infect people. There are seven of them. Four of them will produce common cold symptoms, and these were first studied back in the 1960s. But then everything changed around with the emergence of SARS. Okay, a little bit more about the virus. I'm getting off track here. if we look at SARS-CoV-2, as I said, it's extremely small. How small is it? Well, I want you to imagine the head of a pin. We can fit 15,000 virus particles end-to-end across the top of the head of a pin. That's how small it is. So the virus particle itself, as I said, has those spikes sticking out, very tiny, spherical, or mostly spherical in its shape. And it has a structure that not only has its blueprints, which are locked tightly with a protein inside of this protective type structure, but it has an outer envelope. And this envelope is made of a fabric that is ripped off. Believe it or not, it's ripped off from the cell that the virus infects. So when new virus particles are being made, and this is fascinating, the virus particles themselves, as they assemble inside of this infected cell, will wrap themselves with swatches of this internal membrane and then stud it with proteins. And actually, those proteins come into play when we begin to look at antigens and antibodies. But we'll save that for later. But I think that gives you an idea of what this virus is. So the virus is basically a carrier for bringing its blueprint. And the blueprint for these coronaviruses is an RNA. Most people are familiar with DNA. RNA is another of the nucleic acids. And nucleic acids are a group of chemicals which code for proteins. They carry the blueprints of life. And that's all that the virus does, is it injects its blueprints into a cell, hijacks it, and we make more viruses.
So you're talking about various kinds of coronaviruses, and you mentioned cold symptoms. Now, this COVID-19 virus is more contagious than other viruses we've encountered, right? So why?
Great question. Because there were probably certain mutations which made it more effective and efficient in latching on to certain receptors and potential health host cells. What I mean by that is, in order for a virus to penetrate a cell, it needs to make contact with the cell. And it's almost like pressing a combination on a doorbell lock to get inside of a house, that the virus has got to make the right contact. And these coronaviruses, the COVID-19 virus, locks in with what's called an ACE2 receptor. And it's just an area on top of a host cell in which it makes contact with what's called its spike protein. Remember those clubs that I talked about that stick out of the viral envelope? It makes contact, the S protein undergoes a change, it breaks apart, and then what it then does is it opens it up for the virus then to get inside of the cell and take it over. Now, as I said before, that there are a number of coronaviruses that are out there. In fact, they're fairly common. There are estimates that range anything from 10 to 30%. And notice I'm going to hedge my numbers because you can look at different research papers saying different, giving different values. But between 10 to 30% of the common colds that we've had are probably been caused by coronaviruses, not SARS-CoV-2. Or not the SARS virus, or not the MERS-CoV virus. What we're looking at are these other types of viruses which cause these symptoms which are not serious, like the common cold. We go through them. Good percentage of us have been infected with a type of coronavirus, not this specific one.
So could the number or type of coronaviruses that we've been exposed to in the past impact how our body responds to COVID-19? Because this is really confusing when you see some people get it.
A lot of this, scientists still are not sure. Most likely, what the research suggests is that probably not. It's probably not going to protect you. However, protection itself is something that we're studying and trying to figure out what's going on, because there's two real responses that you have to an infection, whether it's the COVID-19 virus or whether it's some bacterial infection. Your two responses are an innate and an adaptive response. The innate response goes right at it. So if the virus is get into your body, say you breathe in a mist that has these viruses, you don't have to wait to build up antibodies. You have a system which is fighting these foreign invaders. There are cells called phagocytes that eat, that surround these foreign invaders, take them in. You have other ones which will take them apart. So you have this innate response. You also have a long-term adaptive response, and that is the building up of antibodies against the reappearance of this same pathogen. So with those two, most likely you're not getting the antibody protection if you have a different type, if you have a different type of coronavirus. There's questions out about innate, what goes on there, whether it primes or not. And again, the jury is still out on that, so I don't want to go into that. But most likely, infections with these other coronaviruses do not protect you from getting
COVID-19. Yeah, no, but do we have any? Do we have any idea why it doesn't seem to be hitting children as hard as adults? And we should say some children have gotten this, but majority, it doesn't seem to be hitting young people as it is with older. Do we have any clue as to why?
Yeah, you know, it's baffling. There's a couple of reasons. You know, my last answer actually leads into this, because one of the theories is that children have a better innate response, so they can quickly address a viral load that comes into their body. Other suggestions or theories look at the concept that older individuals have underlying health conditions which might compromise them. Or they also may smoke. You have other things. So nobody knows for certain, but there are quite a few theories that are out there. Personally, I like the innate response in children being much stronger than in adults. And so you need an effective viral load. In fact, that is at the heart of looking at the latest CDC changes to what is infectious with the virus, where recently, if you've been following it, they've talked about getting viruses from surfaces, and that's not as effective as it was once thought of a transmission path. And that has to do with the amount of viruses that are transferred, because we probably can deal with some of them with our innate response. So what it seems like now, that the major transmission is through droplets, is through somebody talking, is in close quarters where the virus is spread that way, as opposed to touching it and then bringing it up to your mouth, where you're probably not bringing in an infectious dose, a high enough dose of the viruses, because then your body can just kind of rid itself of these infections before they set an infection.
So can children be asymptomatic but still spread the virus?
Yes, they can.
Yes, okay.
In fact, it's scary. Not only children can do it, but adults can do it as well. There were initial questions about how many virus particles can a child spread as to an adult, and they think it is probably up there as well. There are studies, latest ones in Iceland, I think, have it up pretty high. Maybe 50% of the infected individuals don't show any symptoms, but yet they can spread.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Michael Despezio, a biologist, educator, and science author. He's developed a website and blog on the science of the coronavirus. 866-999-4626 if you have questions or you want to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So what do we know about the inflammatory syndrome that is appearing in children that are living in virus hotspots like New York City? Do we know what the link is there to the coronavirus?
Yeah, but we don't know a lot about it. We don't understand a lot. But there are certain things that we do know. First of all, it's rare that there are not a lot of cases. However, that doesn't mean not to be concerned with it, because certainly if it infects one person and you're that person, you don't think that it's a rare disease. It's an actual disease that's impacting you. It's also treatable, that doctors have had success with different treatments on the inflammation. It's serious enough that you need to be in contact with a healthcare professional if you suspect that in a child, if you have a fever that goes on. And you should be in contact with them, because you need to know what the best path for your child's recovery will be. So right now, that's another thing. This is such an evolving situation. Everything is so new that we're learning new things all of the time, that it is really opening our eyes to how we best proceed. And this is new ground, and we have gone incredible strides in the months since the discovery of this virus, but there is so much more to learn.
Yeah. Now, let's go back to SARS-CoV-2. And how that is different or the same as COVID-19. What are the similarities? Because you mentioned COVID-19 is a SARS virus, right?
It's a great question that comes out. The disease itself is called COVID-19. The virus that causes it is called SARS-CoV-2. Interesting, because when the virus was first isolated and when they first identified it, generally there was a preference not to call it the SARS-CoV-2 virus. The reason was they did not want to unnecessarily alarm a population, because SARS, if you remember back, SARS, the severe acute respiratory syndrome, occurred back in 2003 in China, and it caused symptoms, or the deadly respiratory symptoms, and then pretty much, you know, it was treated in 2003, 2004, the numbers of cases fell, and later on there was another virus called MERS, which came about 2012, and MERS was the Middle East respiratory syndrome related coronavirus, causing again the distress in respiratory system. And then we have, back in December, another coronavirus causing more respiratory distress. So it should have been called, or it should have been publicized initially, that this was the SARS-CoV-2 virus. A lot of virologists look at it and they say, you know, this is just another form of the SARS virus. Hence, if we look at its name, SARS-CoV-2, we can see that it is. A number of them felt that it did not deserve to be identified as a separate species. However, in popular language, it was called COVID-19 virus. So the difference is COVID-19 is the disease. SARS-CoV-2 is the actual virus particle that causes it. And by the way, I should mention that SARS-CoV-2, since it is a coronavirus, is a zoonotic type of virus, which means that it can jump hosts. We don't know the complete story of how this virus jumped from its initial population. It was probably infecting bats and then had an intermediate host, which could have been the scaly anteater, the pangolin. That's all in question right now, but it jumped most likely from a bat to this intermediate host and then to humans, probably in Wuhan, China, maybe at the Wuhan seafood market, but we've got to look more into the data on that.
Right. All right. Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from West Tisbury. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning. He's answered quite a few of my questions. If you were to look at the the SARS virus and the current virus under electron microscopy, how would they differ?
Great question. And I believe that you would not be able to see a difference if you're looking at them with a TEM, transmission electron microscope. The real characteristic of these viruses, because they're so close together, the real characteristic which separates them is going to be some changes in the genetic code, and you're not going to be able to see those changes in the nucleotides. Getting a little bit ahead of myself, and that's a great question. Let me backtrack a little bit. As far as structure goes, looking at them through the microscope, it's not going to be like telling the difference between an amoeba or a paramecium. It's going to be that they look very similar. They have similar shapes. They have similar structures. However, the way that we can differentiate them is by looking at what's called their genome. And the genome is their genetic library. And we can see that these coronaviruses have a genetic library which is composed of building blocks. And these building blocks, nucleotides, you can have about 30,000 of them, and then it varies because you've got mutations that are occurring. But there are specific mutations which occur which allow you to differentiate viruses into their different species. So you're able to tell one virus from another, not by its look, but by looking at its genetic code. And that genetic code is very critical to when we begin looking at vaccines. So I trust I addressed that question, that you're not going to see a difference in its appearance. However, the difference will show itself in and also in the way that it infects different types of cells. But it would be that genetic difference in there.
Yeah. Janet, thanks for the question. And we will get to vaccines in a little bit. Let's talk to George, who is calling from Orleans. Hi, George.
Hey, George.
Hi, how are you? Yeah.
Good.
Well, your previous discussion about the genetic composition of the virus is interesting, and it kind of gets to the question that I have. Does the variance in its in how it infects and to the degree that it infects, does that have anything to do with the genetic composition of the host that it infects? And does that account for some of the difference, say, between why we see children who don't seem to be afflicted nearly as much as, say, an elderly population? And could that be also, say, impacted by, say, the amount of pH in mucus or in saliva, you know, into the medium that enables the virus to infect the cell?
What an interesting question, George.
It is a great question, multi-part question. Let me see if I can tease out some of those. First of all, I need to put down a piece that we still don't know everything about it, and all of the research is coming in, and it is not all, you know, the same. We're getting different, understanding different parts about the virus. For example, getting into a cell. And you mentioned about the pH with that. And a number of people were looking at malarial drugs, whether they can affect the pH of these little cell compartments, which are able to take a virus which lands on the surface of the cell and then bring it deeper into the cell so that it penetrates and infects the cell. Looking at whether or not we can affect that. There are two possible routes of getting into the cell. One has the virus fusing. Actually, the exterior of the virus, if you remember, I said that the virus particle had an outside envelope that was ripped off from the cell membrane. Looks very much like the outer cell membrane as well. So when a virus particle sits on top of a potential host, those membranes can recognize itself, themselves, and they can then fuse. And as they fuse together, the virus can then release its genetic code into the cell and infect it. We're also looking at another way of what are called endocytosis, fancy word for saying basically you can form these little T carrier bubbles inside the cell that when a virus lands on the cell membrane, it then initiates, it triggers a set of responses in the cell to form a little bubble in which the virus goes in, which is then drawn deeper into the cell. Again, we don't know fully which of these mechanisms works. And as far as the pH, there were theories that, you know, you might be able to change the pH of that little bubble. And if you change the pH of the bubble, the virus is not going to go into the cell. Again, I believe most scientists will say that this is not a viable mechanism for protecting one against SARS-CoV-2. Now, getting back to your initial part, looking at the genetics of it, the genetics is driving everything. It drives whether a host cell or a potential host cell is susceptible to any virus, because you need that doorbell on the cell membrane of a potential host cell that is going to be rung, and it's going to be correctly binding to a virus. Because if that binding does not occur, if there's a mutation in that host cell, or if there's a mutation in the virus so that that stud that is on the outside of the virus is not consistent with binding to the host cell, then penetration cannot occur. And this is critical. And this really sets you up to look at how or what types of cells a virus can infect. Because if you don't have this binding occurring between that trigger mechanism, which in this case is occurring with that spike protein, the S protein of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and the ACE2 receptor on the surface of those respiratory cells, if that binding does not occur due to some genetic change so that the protein is slightly different, you cannot infect that cell. And so you can see the impact that genetics has, because what it can do is that if there's another mutation later on, say a mutation changes a virus or a bacteria or something where there is a different type of structure to the receptor, maybe there's going to be a different potential host cell.
George, thanks for the question.
That addresses that. So again, it really does fall back to the genetics. I mean, you've nailed it.
Yeah.
And that genetics impacts what the host specificity is for a particular virus.
Yeah. George, thanks. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Now, we talk a lot about the mutation when we talk about the flu virus and how it mutates, and that's why the vaccine changes every year. Do we know if COVID-19, if there's mutation happening here and onto what level?
Yeah, it is mutating. It's interesting. It's a little bit more stable than the flu. It's an RNA virus, which means that it's susceptible to multiple mutations. If you look at areas of the virus, especially if you're going to be developing a vaccine, you want to make sure that there's stability in that structure. Because if you're developing a vaccine, you want to make sure that it's going to address multiple different types of that virus, so that if there's a minor mutation, the vaccine is still going to be effective against it. The good news is that there appears to be stability in the genome at many of the places that we're looking to target with vaccines. So, yes, there is mutations. Interesting enough to note that, you know, mutations, when people hear about it, they go, oh, what's going on with mutations here? Mutations are a natural part of the living condition. And these occur from all sorts of reasons would cause a mutation. And it can be background radiation, can be sunlight. But what this does is it sets up a change in the blueprint of the virus. Most of the time, the change does not impact it. In fact, it's interesting with SARS-CoV-2, some of these mutations can change the genetic code, but the actual protein that is built from that genetic code gets repaired, and it looks like the original protein. So you have changes going all along, which are making slightly different variants of the virus, and in fact, we can use those slightly different variants to trace the virus. And that's why we're able to follow how the virus traveled, where there was one of the strains which came to the West Coast. The New York strain, the one which really set up infection in New York City, didn't travel from the China to the West Coast and to the East Coast, but by tracking its genetics, it appears as if it came from Europe into the Americas. So it gives us a fingerprint, a genetic fingerprint on which we can then trace and learn more about the movement of these viruses. And then those are some of the things we get from learning about the genome.
Lynn writes, I'd like to know more about what the medical community considers to be pre-existing conditions. Does this include autoimmune disorders?
Yes, it does. There are quite a few different pre-existing conditions. Now, if you look at the mortality of COVID-19, what you see is that in many of the cases, someone who is infected with SARS-CoV-2, and the majority will not have major symptoms. The majority of people will feel sick again. You know, it's really questionable about what you're calling significant symptoms, what aren't. But let's say a symptom that results in going into the ICU, that what will happen at that time is that an individual, they believe, has what is called a cytokine storm going on. Okay, so what are the cytokines? We've got to look at your body's response to infection. Your body has a number of chemical alarm messages that it can release if you're infected. So if my cells get infected with a virus, they go, oh, there's something wrong here. What we need to do is we need to ramp up my body's defenses. So it begins releasing these alarm chemicals, which pump up the body's immune defense. Sometimes, especially in older individuals, what this can wind up doing is overdoing the response and causing much more dangerous and mortal symptoms than the virus itself. So in the case of SARS-CoV-2, which is impacting the lungs, what you can then get is a change in the way in which chemicals leave the blood system and go out into the infected lung tissue, and we can have swelling that occurs with more liquid going in, causing these serious respiratory symptoms. So if you have respiratory disorders before, you're more likely to be impacted by a SARS-CoV-2 infection. You know, and you look at what is going on with SARS-CoV-2. How does it kill? How does it impact the cells themselves? And again, scientists don't know the full story, but what they can look at is that when a cell gets infected with SARS-CoV-2, there are a number of things that happen. First of all, the biosynthetic machinery gets overworked in making new virus particles, so the cell can tire out that way. Also, I mentioned before that there are parts of the internal membrane that are ripped out in the assembly of new viruses. This can damage a cell. A cell can also realize that it's infected, and it can trigger its own suicide, which is an interesting process, because if a cell kills itself and the virus is in there, it can stop the infection. So it's killing itself basically to protect the whole individual, which is fascinating.
Yeah, wow.
But what happens is this is occurring in the lining of tissue that's within the lung, and that lining forms a boundary between the air that you take in that has the oxygen that you need, which you need to diffuse into your blood, which normally that lining allows to diffuse from the air, from the alveoli, from these sacs, these air sacs, into the bloodstream. But if you're infected with SARS-CoV-2, what you're doing is you're building a thick layer in and around that sac, around the edges, which prevents the free diffusion, the free movement of oxygen into the blood, and that is why we're having those respiratory distress symptoms.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking with biologist, educator, and science author Michael DeSpezio. He's developed a website and a blog on the science of the coronavirus. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's talk about vaccinations for this. You know, we're hearing it could be a year and a half, but it really takes quite a while to develop a vaccine, right?
Yeah, and it does. And it was great to hear Anthony Fauci speak or actually it was in an NPR interview, I believe, the other day where he said that there is a chance that we will have the vaccine in place by the end of this year, which is incredible if you look at the speed at which the development of this vaccine or the potential vaccines have occurred. There are problems in bringing vaccines out into the general public. One of them is that you don't know if it's going to remain effective. I mean, this is all new ground that we're under. We don't know how long immunity, if immunity is real, how long will it last? If we look at SARS, in fact, we can look and track this immunity, this acquired immunity due to the antibodies that are circulating in the body, that in SARS, after about 3 years, a number of individuals began having fairly low levels of antibodies. So we don't know if it protects after 3 years, and we cannot experiment this way with humans to go find out, especially now with the rush that we're in to get something out there. So one issue with getting a vaccine out is it going to be effective? Is it going to work? There have been other vaccines which they've tried that didn't live up to the promise that one saw within the laboratory. Another one is we've got basically limited trials compared to where you would have a vaccine which would go over a decade in developing, and you'd be able to trial the vaccine with 100,000 people. And in this population, you would find people with all sorts of underlying disorders or diseases or things which would compromise the vaccine. We are not going to have that luxury in these smaller, shorter tests, but we need something out there because this vaccine is going to bring us back as close to a normal as any of the therapies were. And that is what many of us are waiting and hoping for in getting this effective vaccine out. The other problem with getting a vaccine, I mentioned before the cytokine storm, no one knows, and there's a fear that if you have a vaccine that's untested and gets out there, and then somebody gets introduced to the wild type, the actual virus, will it cause an overreaction in the people who have been vaccinated? So these are all concerns in the development of vaccinations, that you want to make sure it's effective, you want to make sure that it's safe, and you want to make sure that it doesn't cause the body to overreact if it does get infected with the actual pathogen.
All right, let's talk to Lisa, who's giving us a call from Harwich. Hi, Lisa.
Hey, Lisa.
Hi there. Hi. I had a couple questions, and unfortunately, it's going to go back to what you spoke of just a bit ago. One was kind of the genetic component. And my understanding of the genetics, it's also how that is manifest is actually environmental, meaning what the cells are around and the different chemical components, basically the physiology. But the other thing I keep reading about is the ACE2 inhibitor, and I was just wondering how that plays into all of this. Is that really just directed at the respiratory component or just the cardiac? And how the...
Great. Now the cardiac component is an interesting one because I mentioned that ACE2 receptor, and it works with... angiotensin, it works with an enzyme, which is part of a process looking at really keeping a level in your cardiac response, and they think that might, in fact, be driving that. But go back again. I'm not sure I followed what your question was on the genetic component.
Well, it's not, I mean, genetics aren't just hardwired. There's the whole environmental component around how our genes are manifest due to the environment that our cells are in. And basically how that can be driven by different things, one of which I was thinking was medications and how there seems to be some correlation between certain medications that are making, I don't know, the affinity to the receptors for uptake more so. So not just purely the genetics, but the environment that our bodies are in that manifests our chemistry and our physiology.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we are an organism which is affected by our environment. And we're working within that. So there are certain things which may affect the virus particle itself. And that's what we're trying to figure out, which of these pieces in the environment will also come into play with looking at the spread of this disease. I mean, we can look at what's a good thing. Recently, they're talking about that it's much safer to be outdoors. Let's take a look at an outdoor environment versus an indoor environment. Again, I'm going to go back to something I mentioned before about the infectious dose, that there's a certain level that you need to become infected with. The current belief now is that if you're outside, you are much safer than being in inside environment, because in an outside environment, even if people are talking, you are dispersing the virus particles, so you don't have a high concentration of that virus, which means you're less likely, not that it's not absolute at all, but you're less likely then to become infected with that virus. So yes, the environment very much impacts your likelihood for becoming infected. And, you know, we're looking there at the external environment, but then we can turn this back to the internal environment. And going back to the internal environment, you know, I mentioned before an innate immune response. There is also the adaptive one, and that is the antibody one, which we're looking at those vaccines. And that whole concept in vaccines is, how do you turn your internal environment against these pathogens? And what we're looking at now with SARS-CoV-2 are incredible types of vaccinations. These are called nucleic acid vaccinations. So again, I'm going to go back to talking a little bit about the genes here. Previously, when one had a vaccination, you were either inoculated with an attenuated or a weakened pathogen, which couldn't cause the disease, but could certainly establish a weak infection, which would ramp up this adaptive immunity, and you'd make the antibodies to the real pathogen if it ever appeared. There was the attenuated version. There was also one which was called an inactivated vaccine. And the inactivated vaccine used either a destroyed pathogen or parts of the pathogen. Again, what both of these did when you were inoculated with these vaccinations was that it caused your body to react to these foreign structures called antigens by making a complementary structure called an antibody, which would bind with the antigen. Now, these days, we're looking, I mean, the two front runners in the vaccinations are using nucleic acids. They're using RNA. This is bioengineered blueprints. This stuff is brilliant. It's bioengineered blueprints that are inoculated into a subject, okay, so a person gets the vaccine. These blueprints, not the virus at all, not parts of the virus, but these are blueprints for making the spike of the SARS-CoV-2 particle. Remember that spike protein on the envelope? And your cells get these blueprints, these RNA blueprints, and what they begin to kick out are just the spikes of the protein. Your body recognizes these spikes that are now circulating in its blood system and says, oh, wow, we've got a foreign invader. I need to make antibodies. So the body starts cranking out these complementary binding structures called antibodies against the spikes. At that point, you don't have to worry about infection because all you're getting is spikes. You're not getting the actual virus. But later on, if the real virus appears, your body's environment now is set to react immediately to the presence of the new virus because you have a population of these circulating antibodies that recognize the viral spike. And when they recognize the viral spike, they can do all sorts of things. They can distort the spike so that that binding mechanism between the viral spike and that ACE receptor, the receptor on the host, doesn't work well, or it can actually mask it. It really depends. And that's why we've got dozens of potential vaccines that are out there. The one I think most people are familiar with is that Moderna one. It's the mRNA-1273 is the other name. And this is a vaccine which is delivered inside what's called a nanoparticle. Sounds like I'm talking Michael Crichton here.
Yeah, I was going to say, we have full lines, Michael, and only a few minutes left. So I think we got the answer to Lisa's question.
Another call, or should I finish that one up?
Let's get Kate in from Falmouth. Hi, Kate.
Okay.
Hi there. I had been listening to the radio, and I do not remember the program that I heard this on. There were two things that I had questions about. One was that when the virus goes, like, say, it goes into your mouth or your throat or in toward your airway, that it can sit in the back of your throat for, like, 3 days or something. And one of the things that was suggested was that you drink warm water frequently to help wash that down into your stomach, where the acids would take care of that rather than having it grow and then travel into the lungs. That was one. And then the other was that people that had had cancer and had had, chemotherapy and radiation, for some reason had some kind of built up protection. And I don't know if that's true. And so that was my question.
Right. Michael, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, there is so much that is out there with potential. And I'm looking at things as well. I'm trying to follow what is out there. My suggestion would be to check out the CDC site and look and try and get, or the Harvard, you can go to Harvard Medical School, look at what these sites are saying, because if I go on and I begin to look at potential ways of protecting oneself, and I found the same thing. There was one I saw about deep gargling, which was probably similar to the action in which you're talking about here, that, you know, you can get rid of them. Another one was how you breathe, or if you have heartburn. And this isn't looking at how the heartburn drugs might work, but this was looking at if you're swallowing saliva in the back, you're more likely going to be setting yourself up for infection. The thing is, there's so much of that out there. Again, what I would do is suggest go check out the CDC or check out the Harvard sites. John Hopkins, you can certainly go through them. They've got a very rich site that is out, that not only is a fantastic counter on looking at world health, but it also points you to all other fantastic URLs that are rich in data and understanding and research.
And we just have about a minute or a minute and a half left. I'm sorry we're not going to get to all the calls that are. So just in winding up, Michael, rules of thumb for keeping ourselves and others from being infected.
I'm sorry, a rule of thumb. Great.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, we're looking at what the CDC, social distancing is critical. It looks as the major way that this spreads is airborne. You don't want to be in close contact proximity with people for longer amounts of time. If you have children, limit their time with others. You have to really be aware of hand washing 20 seconds, and you have to do a really good job on it, because again, even though it seems that the hand washing might be less of an influence as stated in the latest CDC reports, it is still a way of potentially infecting yourself by touching a surface, bringing it up to your face. But also face covers, cloth face covers. I just saw the attorney, more people from the CDC actually talk about face covering. Yeah. So that's something else that you've got to look at. And that, remember, protects other people from you spreading the virus out to them. So social distancing still being the primary piece and everything in and around it. And you can get all this information. If you put CDC into your web search browser, you are going to get more information than you ever want.
Okay. All right. Michael Despezio, biologist, educator, science author, and he's developed a website and blog on the science of the coronavirus. We'll have a link to that at our website, capeandislands.org. Michael, we'll have to get you back to everything that we didn't get to this morning. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.